Of this show that we call Blind Like Me. My name is Phil Parr. You probably knew that. But we're glad to come into your homes, and we're glad you invited us. If you're on ACB Radio, well, or run of the radio reading services, it's good to have you. And Don Simonson is our guest. And Don, how are you, sir?
Just fine, Phil. Very good. You?
Yes, sir. I'm doing well. It's cold, colder than I like.
We got just the opposite here.
Really?
In fact, on the television yesterday, it said that Yuma was the sunniest spot in the nation, that there was sunshine 91% of the time here.
91% of the time?
91% of the time.
And you're in Arizona. What was the temperature there where you are? What do you think?
Pardon?
What would be the temperature where you are right now?
Oh, right in the morning, it's usually about 50, 55 maybe, and then in the afternoons it's been getting up to about 75 or so, and that's I think the coldest we've seen here for any daytime temperature is probably around 55 or so. We just don't have winter down here.
And this is your winter home. This is where you go every year to spend the winter.
Right. I'm what's called a snowbird, and my home is up in Kennewick, Washington, up in the eastern part of the state of Washington. And we started out coming down here coming to Arizona about 25 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And we could only stay, I remember the first trip was 3 weeks down here, and then the next trip was a month, and then it kept kind of getting longer and longer as we dropped parts of the business that we could be away from.
Uh-huh.
And we now own a place here in Yuma, and it's what's called a park model, or little cracker boxes in a senior park, 55 and older. And you own the building, but you lease the land and that sort of thing. I mean, when there were words, they charge you so much a year, a couple thousand dollars a year, and then you own the structure on it. And so we sold the motorhome 3 years ago. We used to come down in the motorhome and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we sold it 3 years ago, and we had already bought this place and started coming back and forth for 2 years in the car. So now we have this place and our place in Kennewick.
Well, what happens when you pass away? What happens to the structure there? Do they get it back, or do they buy it back from you?
No, the structure belongs to us. We can sell it. I mean, it's actually a piece of property that you could sell, just like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they are movable, but for the most part, once they're set up like ours is here with the deck on it and that sort of thing. And they're very small. We only have about 360 square feet, which gives you one bedroom, a living room and kitchen, of course, and a place to park your car. And ours has on the back half of the deck normally runs the length of the rig, and the last, 14 feet towards the back has a room built on over the deck, which is called an Arizona room, so we have the equivalent of two bedrooms here.
Uh-huh.
But when I cash in my chips, the land, in fact, if I don't pay my rent next year, the land reverts to the man that owns the land, and I better find a buyer for my place here, or it would be possessed. You know, I mean,
would become his by default because he owns the land it's on.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mentioned to my wife that I built in 1999. We built this house in 91. In 99, I built a building to house my wood shop and my recording studio. And I mentioned that I own this building. And she said, "Well, unfortunately, sir, you built it on my land."
Oh, man.
So I don't know what that means. But anyway, so what is your level of vision, Don?
My what?
Level of vision.
Oh. I'm totaled out. I had, probably, it's hard to say in percentages, but I probably had 2 or 3% when I was a kid that probably lasted me up into my, when it went away, probably around age 30 maybe.
Yeah.
But it was the type of sight that I could follow a sidewalk because of the dark grass on either side of it, that kind of thing, and maybe not bump into a car if it was parked across the sidewalk.
Maybe you wouldn't bump into the car.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe I wouldn't.
So, but that of course that helped, and there's no question about that.
Yeah.
And you, when you were a child, where did they decide to school you as a youngster, 6 years old?
Well, thank God for an aunt of mine. If it had been left to my folks, I would have been probably a vegetable home on the farm. But my dad was killed when I was about 4, and we moved out west. My mother remarried, and my stepdad was a rancher, and they just didn't. He didn't have much schooling back of him and couldn't see any sense in why I should, and mostly he didn't know where to send me. And I had an aunt who, my mother's sister, who was kind of a, for those days back in the 20s would have been, almost a flapper. I mean, she had herself a one hell of a good time and was single and so on. She came home one day. I had just turned 8, I think. And she says, "Oh, sis, you got to send Donnie to this wonderful school." And she had been to Vancouver and somehow or other visited the Washington State School for the Blind. And how she ended up there, I don't know. But she stopped. She's one of these people that's interested in everything. And I suppose it was just curiosity. And so they finally sent me down there then that fall, and so I got my schooling through the Washington State School for the Blind in Vancouver, Washington.
Now, do you have other siblings? Did you have kids at home?
Well, I had a brother that was just 2 years younger than I am, and then my Felix, my stepdad, and my mother had one boy between them, so I had a half brother also.
And this was a farm that you were raised on. They were farming.
We had everything that had hair or feathers on it, I think, and I hated every minute of it. But I did with a lot of the milking and. Uh-huh. And haying and that kind of thing. The old man was one thing that was, I'll have to thank him for, and it's probably one of the very few things I can thank him for, is that he allowed that poor little Donnie wasn't going to get away with anything. And my mother was forever saying, "Well, Donnie can't do this and Donnie can't do that," and so on. And the old man says, "There isn't a damn thing on this whole ranch that works 100%. The only thing I can see wrong with that kid is that his eyes don't work, but his boots and his belly and everything else work, so we'll utilize that." and he did. He gave me a crack at almost everything without putting me in in line of danger, you know. That's
a, yeah, and that's probably, as you said, a good thing, because you may have learned some skills there that a lot of blind kids don't get to learn.
In fact, I remember one thing in particular. We had a lot of, we used to raise a lot of chickens, and one year we were shingling the chicken houses, and these were long buildings. They were like 120 feet long and 40 feet wide or so.
Yeah.
And the old, I would go along laying shingles. This is the old 24-inch cedar shingles, and laying shingles, and my brother and my dad would come behind me nailing, and geez, the neighbors just raised holy nit about that cool old man, that little blind boy up on that roof and so on. But he used to always lay a roll of tar paper down. He'd say, okay, when you get to this point, stop. And it would usually be 3 feet in from the edge, you know, and that sort of thing. But, like I say, he didn't put me in any danger, but he didn't let me get away with anything either. And then I milked the cows, of course. We had usually always had at least a dozen milk cows, and slopped the hogs and hauled chickens yet till you're blue in the face, you know, and that sort of thing. And,
you know, sighted people fall off of roofs every day.
That's for sure. Well, in later years, I always tell people, you know, they worry about when I'm up on a roof or up on anything, because I do a lot of my own homework and that sort of thing, and I just tell them that blindness doesn't excuse you from the pull of gravity. It's there.
Well, you know, people ask you to run in your table saw or run in a big saw. How do you keep from getting hurt? Well, I'm just real careful. I don't want to get hurt.
Right. That you have to do it. But I think giving them a sensible answer that way is, some people get pretty snotty or pretty snippy about their answers, and I just don't approve of that. I think if someone asks a question, they want an answer that will improve their knowledge, and if you don't give it to them, then you've duped yourself, actually.
So. That's true. All right, so they sent you at beginning of your first grade year to the, you say, Washington State School for the Blind.
Yeah, in Vancouver, Washington. That was in, I think it was 1931, the fall of 1931.
You were 6 years old then, or how old?
Actually, I was closer to eight. I was born in 1923, and I was born May of 23, and for some goofy reason that I've never been able to figure out is that I should have hung around in there until July. I was about 2 months preemie. Mm-hmm. I always hated being cold, and all my life I hate being cold. Why I wanted to get out of that nice warm place, I don't know. But I still don't like to be cold to this day, and I'm about ready to cash in my chips. So,
and you're 84 years old.
I'll be 84 in May.
Is that right?
And I'm in pretty good health, actually. When I started slowing my business down some, I decided, and my wife had, my wife is sighted, and she was retiring as a registered nurse, and so I decided that I would get a guide dog, and I was 61 years old when I got my first dog, and since that time, I've had dogs now for about 23 years, and I still walk about at least a mile a day, and sometimes 2 miles a day if I'm feeling really ambitious. But I try to get in a mile a day. And oddly enough, here at this park that we winter in, from my steps down to, we call it Doggyville, and back is 3/10 of a mile. And I make that run about six times a day so I can log a mile and eight tenths just taking my dog to potty.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing wrong with that. It's actually, there's nothing wrong with that. My driveway is 500 feet long, so if I go get the mail, I've walked 1,000 feet.
Right.
And if I do that five times, I've walked a mile.
That's right.
Pretty close. Okay, so you Blind School, and this was 1931. Times were tough then, weren't they? I mean, it was the Depression was on, and the economy was.
That was kind of the peak of the Depression, and so on, but fortunately, if you could stand what institutions do to food,
yep.
You didn't go hungry.
And did they begin teaching you Braille at that time?
In fact, they started us right out in Braille. Everybody got a shot at Braille, some of the kids, you know, there's varying degrees of sight and that sort of thing, and some of them could read large print, but you had to take a crack at Braille. And one of the kind of amusing things that I noticed, we got just a very small exposure to the Perkins Braille writer, and it was always in the second grade.
Mm-hmm.
But they only had about, I don't remember, but it was only just three or four, maybe five of the Perkins Braille writers. And so we got very little use on them, and then it was back to the old slate and stylus. And I still have my old Braille slate, the four-line, 28-cell slate, made of brass. And I noticed that, here a few years ago, my Braille was getting harder and harder to read, and I thought, God, my fingers aren't getting that bad. So I got looking at the back side of it, and the little cups, you know, that you poke
the
Braille out.
Yeah.
They had just about worn flat. They felt flat rather than pointy from just sliding it across the desk, you know. And of course, this took place over a period of probably 65, 75 years. And anyhow, I had a friend take a punch and just go through and tap them and make them, deepen them a little bit again. Hell, that lasted about, maybe a month.
Yeah.
And by that time, they were flatting.
You know, they make these nice aluminum slates that you might want to consider.
Yeah, I have a couple of those. But the trouble of it is, If you're doing anything with older Braille, if you want to copy something back on the same page, you know, and they went, if they'd have left those at 28 cells and four lines, but most of them are 26 or 27, and then they started that crazy thing where your paper lifts up with the top hinge, you know, and so on. And I, of course, the only thing I use Braille for really was just personal notes, and I did my reading on the talking book and tape machine and that sort of thing. And then, of course, since the advent of computers, I use it quite extensively.
Notice. Oh, so you are computer literate? You play on the you have a computer and you work you use it?
I do now, But of course, that's only been about for the last.
Yeah, 10 years.
Years or so.
But most people your age won't embrace that technology. You know, they think it's too. My father-in-law, 72, and he just will not fool with them.
I know, and I think that they just don't want to put forth the effort and that sort of thing. And it does take some doing to get it, but I don't know. It's to me, it's a challenge. In fact, Lauren Buntemeyer, the fellow you mentioned. Lauren is quite a guru on computer programming and that kind of thing. But he's been just an immense help to all of us guys. And I'm old enough to be Lauren's dad, but He still has got patience enough to pound it into me to explain how to move a file to a folder, you know, that kind of thing. 'Cause And
yeah,
but I find it challenging. In fact, I play quite a bit of poker online. I play against the computer, though, instead of my cheating neighbor.
The rewards of learning the computer are vast outweigh the effort you put forth.
Being able to
sit down and type a letter to someone
or make
a copy of it and being able to exchange emails and it's just I don't know how I live without the damn thing now. You know.
That's the way I feel about it. And my wife has she has a computer also, but we got to the point where, you know, if you have JAWS. I happen to be a JAWS user. If you happen to have JAWS open and she comes in to use my computer and say you're going to type in something on a form or something where you got to go into forms, it just don't do it unless you do it. So I put JAWS into her machine so I could help her out some if she gets in trouble. But I have to actually... Shut JAWS off, otherwise that thing responds like a JAWS machine rather than a ordinary machine for a sighted person.
My wife does the same thing. Did you with this blind school? Did you graduate the Washington State School? Did you?
Yeah, I graduated in 1943, and that was right in the middle of World War II.
Yes, sir. We were in the war by then.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were in the war by then. And a part of the education at the Washington State School was piano tuning. And it was the only industrial course that I could see that it would be possible to make a living at, because the old man... he always says, if you ever have to go on welfare, he says, you come home and work on the ranch here and that sort of thing. And I told him that would be one long, cold day. But
I love it.
I did not like ranching at all. And so anyhow, I took tuning as kind of a reluctant thing. And Emil Fries was actually... the instructor there at that, and he had been the instructor through all the years that I was there. And I had just enough sight to go pile wood down at his place and that kind of thing. You know, I was kind of his boy Friday. And but anyhow, I didn't really apply myself in tuning. I was good at the repairs, but it really didn't like the tuning end of it. And so kind of here I am graduated, and I went out that summer, and at that time there was 7 jobs for every man to fill them, you know. Guys were in the service and stuff, and I pounded the streets of Seattle for... about 2.5 months during the summer there.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided that, by God, if I couldn't get a job when there were 7 men to fill, I mean, 7 jobs to fill, 7 jobs for
every man,
what would it be like when there were 7 men for each job? So I buckled in, went back to school, and I finished up my tuning. It took me 2 years because I hadn't applied myself quite as much as I should. But the next summer, I went up on the island. I grew up on Whidbey Island, just north of Seattle. And there hadn't been a tuner up through that part of the country since the year one. And I found out there's quite a few pianos. And, you know, at $6.50 a tuning... in those days, I ended up that summer making a little over $1,100 for 3 months.
Really?
That was more money than my old man made.
That was a good chunk of change, wasn't it?
That really was. And so I thought, this is for me. So I went back to school and finished up my my last year then and stuff, I worked almost full-time at one of the music stores in Portland as under supervision. But anyhow, I hit the deck with my brand-new shiny set of tools in 1945 on June 6th and decided I was going to have to make a living at this. So I cast it around some and tried different locations. And one of the things is that one of the other graduates that came back that was at least paying the rent with tuning said that you got to find the right spot. And he said it may take you a little while, a couple of years and so on. So I tried Bellingham, and the old tuner there didn't like me particularly because I didn't do things his way. And so I went to Tacoma, and that was in another town south of Seattle. And the guys were all there. The business pretty well sewed up. Sewed up,
yeah.
Right. So anyhow, then I ended up back. I went back to Portland because I did have a foothold in at the United Piano Company where I got a lot of my senior training, and I made it around to all of the old-timers that were nice, comfortably settled and so on, and there was lots of work out on the coast. None of those guys wanted to go out to the Oregon coast because it was the crappiest weather on God's green earth during the winter months. But anyhow, I had these nice, shiny tools. I wanted to put them to work, and so I let it be known that I was willing to go anywhere, any place that there was work.
Yeah.
And I put in 5 years galloping up and down the Oregon coast and all these little towns. I covered about a 160-mile run and I did it about once a month, down to one end and then back up the other side, you know. But I came out of there with a new Chevrolet bought and paid for and $7,000 in the bank.
So why not?
And so then I kind of kept working Portland, and there's too many guys around that there wasn't any work to do and stuff. So, hell, I was turning away work, and Portland at that time didn't have a lot of the high bridges to cross the Willamette River, and you were forever having to cross the river, but there was drawbridges, and they were always open when you were in the biggest hurry, you know, so you turned away so much work on the west side.
Yeah.
So anyhow, I started hiring these guys and put in a shop and found myself after a while running around with an oil can, putting out fires, so to speak, running down nuisance calls, in other words, but those guys were still getting their pay. I was still doing a pretty nice gross on the thing. In 1960, a guy came along from back in Michigan, and he said, "Boy," he said, "one of these guys, I'm going to move out here to the Northwest and start a shop."
So you were 35, 36 years old by then.
Yeah.
And you had tuned pianos ever since you got out of high school.
Oh yeah, I've tuned ever, and even now it's the only thing I've done really.
Yeah.
But it was a great business and stuff. Someone's not going to pile them up on your porch, but if any guy that isn't making, with the training that we had, that isn't making at least $60,000 a year on today's economy, plain is not trying and stuff. It's just, and I had to do it really because we just didn't have computers back then. You didn't get a usable computer until probably 10, 12 years ago.
So you did it because you had to eat. I mean, this was your way of making a living and surviving.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I like nice things, and so the way to get them was to fill a need.
Was to work.
That's what I felt I did.
So this guy was going to open a shop where now?
He'd like to come. He said he was going to come out here. He was from northern Michigan. He's going to come out here and open a shop like mine. Because we had a pretty nice shop. We had a repair shop for stringing and action work and that sort of thing, and refinish shop, and I had a couple of old trucks that we delivered and picked them up with and so on. And so I said, well, why don't you buy this one? And because I was getting sick of Portland, I was turning away so much work because of the traffic pattern. Now they have, I think there's four or five high bridges that you can get back and forth across the river, so you don't have to. You hardly ever get held up in your traffic. So I wouldn't mind going back there again, except for the rain. I hate rain.
Oh, well, let's don't do that. Just let's don't jump to any conclusions. You got it made in Arizona there. Let's don't get carried away now. And so this guy bought your shop.
Yeah, that's right. I priced it to him so he couldn't say no. And then I moved east of the mountains up to my current location in Kennewick, and it's about 200 miles east of Portland up the Columbia River, only it's in Washington, just about 25 miles from the Oregon line. And I put in 46 years up there. In fact, last October, on 6th of October, I hung it up completely. My shoulder's gone to hell, and my ears are getting, I've lost about half of my hearing.
And
you can tune with hearing aids in, but boy, you got to be, use a lot of restraint not to grab the voicing needle to start voicing things, because everything sounds so shrill and microphonic, you know.
Well, guy'd have to be awful hungry to tune with hearing aids in. Guy'd have to be awful hungry to tune with hearing aids in.
Well, I only have done it the last couple of years, but I had some contracts that I had to finish up, and I kind of had to do it, but I wasn't real pleased with the results, you know, and so on.
Tuning has been your only way of making a living, but Lauren indicated that you had done several other things, I guess, as hobbies.
I had a ham radio license. I haven't been active in the last couple of years. Well, actually, since 2004, the people and the computers, the last 5 years, I suppose, so you don't have the chat rooms. I let my license just lapse, and so, well, I don't know if this lapsed or not. But my license goes back to 57, but the last 3 years, I hauled my ham gear back and forth from home to down here to Arizona 3 years in a row, and never opened the box on either end, so I thought it was time to sell it.
Time to not take that anymore, haul that stuff around. Yeah.
And my main hobby through the years was restoring vintage cars, and I always was very mechanical, and I like the old cars of the 30s, you know, and that sort of thing. And I had, all through the years, I suppose, you know, you get a car and start restoring it, and then you get tired of it, or a guy find a better deal, and so on. And it, I suppose through the years, I had 100 or more cars that...
Really?
And... In fact, the last one I finished up was a 1939 Chevrolet, and I used to do everything to them except the painting and the welding. Those are two things that I just couldn't master.
Mm-hmm. And you restored these old cars as in you sanded them down and put Bondo in the places that needed Bondo. Did you do the engine rebuilding of these cars?
Yeah, the engine. And I was a lot better at the engine rebuilds and the other mechanical end of it. I liked that a lot better than I did the body and fender work. That was kind of a drag, but I did it because you couldn't rope anybody else into doing it.
You had an engine hoist so that could take an engine out of a car. And
what uses a cherry picker, a portable cherry picker. It's a little roll-around stand that has the toes coming out forward so it can't tip on its nose, and then you have a short boom on it. You just reach in there and put a chain around the engine and hydraulic jacks. You lift the engine up and pull her forward. And then we had an engine. I had an engine stand. There are a couple of engine stands and that you'd mount the engine on so you could tilt it, roll it, and stuff like that, you know. That was my favorite work, is that kind of thing. And I guess that was one of the things I learned back on the farm, because we had some of the craziest old running crap around there, but the old man didn't care anything about whether we used it or whether we didn't. But you could either go down and harness up a team and hook it to the wagon, or you could take the old truck and stuff if you can get it started. My brother and I got pretty good about mechanical ability. My brother was sighted, by the way.
Yeah.
And he did the driving.
Well, of course, yeah. But you learned to work on engines, take one apart, and learned how they worked back on the farm.
I think that, I don't know how many engines I overhauled completely in those cars, but I suppose through the years, probably 50 or 60, because I was slow at it. It was only worth just a part-time killing place to, mm-hmm. you know, kind of give you an excuse to be out in the garage drinking beer and stuff like that. But it was more relaxing. But I guess, according to my mother, I must have been born with a mechanical gene in my mm-hmm. system, because she said she'd take me into the barber shop, and before she could even get her coat off or anything, I'd be under the sink trying to figure out how to take his plumbing apart, you know.
Yeah, trying to figure out how, and everywhere you go, if you sit down at a table, do you look at that table and try to figure out how they put it together?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Well, you're not by yourself. There are lots of us who do that. There are just lots of us who have to know. My father would buy something, bring it home, take it apart, figure out how it worked, put it back together, and then we could use it.
Yeah, that's right.
A toaster, a waffle iron, it doesn't make any difference. My mother used to get so angry, you know.
With the vintage cars, I used to always try to buy a junker parts car along with the car that I was going to restore, because much of that kind of stuff, you couldn't figure out how to get it apart, so you could use the crowbar on it. And if you wrecked it, then once you got this out of the way, then you could say, oh, yeah, that's how it goes together. And then you'd go over to your restorable car and take that knowledge and put it to work. So,
in other words, so you make one good car out of two.
Yeah, one good car and a bunch of junk that you sold to the scrap iron guy when you got through with it and stuff.
Now, we're talking Model A's and Model T's and those kinds of...
Mostly the ones I liked were the Chryslers, Chevys, and when the Ford, I don't know, I never was terribly interested in the Model A, mostly because they seemed like such a tin can affair, but when he came out with the V8, then I got interested in it and so on through the late 30s. I liked the cars of the late 30s, and of course there weren't any cars of the 40s, so you had to go to the late 40s on those.
During the war they didn't make any cars.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, 46 I think they started making.
Yeah, 46 it came back, and then that's when they brought out the Hudson and some of those. I remember the used to be so silly, they put chrome door handles on it and then paint them black just to satisfy the war effort, you know. Kind of ridiculous.
But. Yeah, and then in 49, I think we had the step-down Hudson. Remember that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Before that, I think it was the Terraplane Hudson.
Yeah.
Funny looking cars. We're blind kids. Like to walk around cars and look at them. So I, you know, at one time I was very interested in cars. I could listen to one and tell you what it was by hearing.
Yeah, that was the thing that I liked about once you got the engine back to that point where you get it started and then start smoothing it out and so on. It was one of the things that I liked very, very much about, and it was a very relaxing thing. I never made any money at any of these cars, but yeah. I'll have to say, going back to one of your earlier questions I was going to answer about my living, is I can honestly say that without exception, I have made everything that I have today, every last dime I've made it with my little old kit of tuning tools. I didn't, the old man and I never got along at all, so consequently, when he crashed in his chips, my half-brother got the whole ranch, and it sold last March for $380,000, of which I had none of.
Really?
So everything that I've made, I made some investments in the stock market, some good, some bad, and that sort of thing. But
sure.
I've got a good retirement now. I've never drawn a penny of welfare, and I've only worked a year on salary and hated every minute of it the whole time because it binds your hands when you're on salary. You can't experiment and try different things, you know.
So all the money you've made has come from you hustling pianos to tune and tuning them and collecting the money.
Right.
Yeah.
It always had to do with pianos, and I sold them, I rented them, I rebuilt them, moved them, and tuned them.
Yeah.
It's been a great business, actually, and I'm going to, when it's going to really hit the fan, it's when I go back home. I got to go back home probably about middle of March because we've got a few things to finish up on closing out the business and so on, and I got to get back in time for taxes.
Oh, yeah.
And this year we're going to have a few capital gains, you know, and that sort of thing, but... the bulk, I mean, I made a few bucks in the stock market, but most of it has been, yes, ma'am, that'll be $154, and we'll give you a call in 6 months. And that's kind of where it is, just piece by piece.
Now, but you had, at the last, you say, close out the business. Did you have a music store or a piano store? What did you have there?
I had a moving storage outfit. That was, we started out for our own, and pretty soon you started doing it for other people, you know, stuff, and then it got out of hand. And so I sold it, and then we had a few pianos left from the retail outlet that, to get rid of and so on. But I am done with it. My shoulder is just, gives me too much trouble anymore.
You can't hold that hand up and pull the tuning hammer around anymore.
Actually, I would have had to quit probably 30 years ago, except that I got, I don't know, are you in the trade or not?
I took piano tuning and I did a little bit in the early days, and then I discovered music. I discovered I could play the guitar, and I liked that a lot better.
Yeah, well, that's the thing that happens with the holding your arm up there like that, that got me in the back, and then I tumbled into, I don't know if you ever heard of this swinger tuning hammer that Francis Mahaffey developed. It was a more sophisticated name, was the impact hammer. But it was a different principle of tuning. Rather than with your shoulder, you did it with your wrist and so on. And he added about another 35 years of work time to my schedule by learning to use that tool of his.
I've never seen one, never heard about one. Tell us, how does it work mechanically?
Actually, Francis was a Canadian guy, and by his own admission, he was a piano technician, but he was more of an inventor, and he invented more damn tools than you shake a stick at for tuners, and some of them were kind of crude, but they all worked and stuff. I've got every tool that guy ever made. And but anyhow, I got the idea for this impact hammer, and they were changing the tires on his car in a service station one day, and they had the using the air impact, you know, that, you know, and he thought, well, why can't that work to tune to turn the tuning pins? So what it is, this thing has a weighted handle up at the top. It's a 2-inch weight on about a 11-inch tall handle, and then the base the tip, instead of being solid like it is in a conventional hammer, it has about a 10-degree rotation, if you follow what I mean. It's got that much. You could turn the tip back and forth about 10 degrees without the handle even moving. You follow me?
Yes, I do.
And so what you do is you hold your hand, hold it down by the tip. I usually put the tip between my pointer finger and my middle finger, and you flip it with your wrist. And you have to do it very relaxed, like you're swinging a claw hammer. If you grip that claw hammer real tight and start pounding a nail, you're hitting all around it and stuff. Let it swing loose in your hand, and that hammer, that old nail goes bong, 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 and it's in. And that's kind of the way with the impact hammer. It's got to be relaxation, so it takes all the weight off your shoulder and back, puts it on your wrist, forearm.
I would probably have to see one of these to completely understand how they work. I've never heard of this. Are they commonly used by tuners these days?
Oh, it's like the tuning business is like anything else. The you never convert some of the old timers to it, but through the years I've taught it. Let's see, two of the international PTG conventions and probably a half a dozen regionals, and teaching the use of the impact hammer, because it's just like you can read all the books you want to on flying an aeroplane, but by God, I'll bet you're not going to crash it if you're just going to take it off on the strength of the book. You got to have somebody with their hand on it on the throttle, you know.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the way it is with the impact hammer. I had seen them at conventions, but nobody ever demonstrated. Yeah, here's a good tool. Try it. I taught it several times. I suppose through the years, I probably converted 1,000 people to it.
But then you still have to reach up and move the hammer to the next pin.
Oh yeah. You can. What I always do is use my pointer finger and say I'm moving up from F to A. I go up 1, 2, 3, 4 with my pointer finger, and I just take the hammer right with me, and then I slip it on the pin when I'm there. And that's what most tuners do. You know?
But you're still reaching. So when you tune, do you stand up or sit down?
Most of the time I sit down, and even with the big uprights, I remember one convention, they gave me a great big old Bush and Lane upright. God, that thing must have been 58 inches tall. And so I was demonstrating how to sit with the tuning, but actually it's almost easier to teach it when you're sitting down, because the guy can't put his shoulder into it if he's sitting below the hammer, you know. That's the tendency in the conventional of where your shoulder's about at level with the tuning pins,
and
you always want to turn around and put your shoulder into it.
When you're using that, you're using that shoulder to actually move the hammer. That's what I did.
Well, that's all. The only time you're using it to move the hammer, though, is to carry it from one pin to another. But once it's on that pin, it's strictly wrist motion.
Okay, I need to see one of these. Maybe I can find somebody who's got one. I don't.
Yeah, what they're called is they used to be called the swinger hammer or the Mahaffey hammer, and it has this rotating tip. You see them around. Most of the guys, if they bought them, where they didn't buy them with a demonstration, if they just hauled off and bought it because they thought it was an impulse thing. Most of them have one laying in the drawer. They never use it.
Because they don't know how to use it.
Yeah, that's right. You got to know how to use it, and that's what where I, my value came in. The very first convention that I taught at was at the International in, I think it was Portland, and I told, I called Francis Mahaffey, and I says, you know, I'm going to be doing this class using your hammer. I said, why don't you send me up a dozen of them? I says, you know how guys are with impulse buying, and that time I think they sold for $40 or $50, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And so he sent me up five, and for that, my combined class, I had four sessions, and I think I had 136 guys show up for my class. I mean, I had my hand on the shoulder of 136 guys in that class. Well, out of it, I sold, I think it was 54 hammers, and but I only had the five, and I'd hang on to them, and one of them for dear life, so I'd have a demo hammer. And so I told the guys, I said, okay, you have a check for $40. Francis says, you, if any of you sell, he says, I'll give it $10 off. So I says, I had a, everybody send me a check made out to Mahaffey and send it to my house. I gave him my address and that sort of thing in 1 week's time. And I sent him down this manila envelope with 54 checks.
Really?
And he liked to keel over. He hadn't sold that many of his hammers in his whole
career. So he had to get busy and manufacture that many. Yeah.
Well, it's without a demonstration, it's just about worthless. I mean, because I've given you an explanation, but you see, I don't
understand it. No, sir, I don't. Frank with you, I
wouldn't.
No.
And so, and that's the thing about it. Of course, I'm a little bit too old to get back into anything like that anyhow, but if it were something that didn't take all the contact time, and most of these guys, their shoulders don't start going to hell until they get maybe in their 50s.
Yeah.
And then by that time, then their mind is set. So
I have just now, and I'm 66, just now started having rotator cuff problems.
Oh, yeah.
I can't lay on that side, and I can't lift the coffee pot anymore.
Yeah.
I can lift it to pour a cup of coffee, but I can't set it. I can't set a cup of coffee in the microwave anymore with my
right hand. Hold it up for any length of time.
No, I can't hold it. And that just started 3 months ago, and it's driving me crazy. Because I wake up. It wakes me up every night. Sleeping, I try to roll over on that side. Boy, getting old is just not what it's cracked up to be, is it?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the other things that I do as a hobby and have for many, many years, but I do it a lot now. I play a lot of pinochle and a lot of cribbage, and
really?
I play it's all with sighted people, and the conventional deck of cards that you buy from any of the adaptive supply houses are always brailled on the face. And you can't, if you're playing with a bunch of blind people, it works out fine and dandy.
Yeah, but sighted people, it wouldn't, would it? No.
That's right. And I play exclusively with sighted people, not because I'm snobbish, but because there isn't any others to play with sighted people. But I play about 6,000 hands a year, and I can play right up to speed with them. Last night I played pinochle, and there was 12 tables of four, and you play four hands at each table and that sort of thing. And
yeah.
So you're always changing part, and I have, but holding my cards, I braille them on the back instead of on the front.
Makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah.
And I can pick them up just as fast as a sighted guy, unless I'm the dealer. Then I fall maybe 30 seconds behind or something like that. But.
And at this retirement place where you live, or there in Yuma, they have old folks get together and do that, or what?
Oh yeah, the we have a rec hall. We play pinochle on Tuesday and Friday night. We play cribbage on Wednesday night, and they play bingo on Sunday and Thursday night, or Monday and Thursday night.
Do they have? Do they serve libation there? Is that, that
no, it's well, they do have a Tuesday afternoon happy hour.
Okay.
And most of these places, especially when the weather gets now, when we get through February, you're going to see seeing a lot of temperatures going up in the 80s and 90s, real nice long evenings and stuff.
Yeah.
And between here and Pottyville, I bet I could find at least four parties going on and stuff.
Okay.
You have to be kind of careful, or you end up getting sloshed every night.
Listen, we've killed an hour, Don.
Oh.
Can you believe it?
God, it doesn't seem like.
We've killed an hour, and you've been most interesting to talk with. I was in Seattle, in close to not too far from you, just last year, and I'm going to come see you one of these days. And you've been most interesting, and I'll tell you what, I'll call you and let you know when we run this on ACB Radio, okay?
Okay. One thing, just before you let you go,
okay.
I've got to make a trip. My wife's oldest son lives in San Antonio, and that's from where we sit here. It's 1,200 miles to San Antonio, and it's 1,200 miles home up to back up to Kennewick. So
yeah.
We're going to leave we'll be gone the week of the 8th, and then we'll be heading for home about the 15th. So it's.
I'll try to run it after that after you get home. How about that?
Yeah, probably if you run it after the 20th of March or 21st of March. After that, we'll be there until the 21st of May, and then we go on to Alaskan cruise with a bunch of guide dog owners.
All right. Well, you have a good time, and I thank you, and I'll be in touch, Don.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, sir. Well, Don Simonson, I think I've never met a person who was easier to interview. You just ask him a question, and he seems to be quite knowledgeable on many, many subjects. I think, what did he say, he was 84? Did he say that? I hope my mind is that sharp at 84, don't you? I hope that I can still converse fluently and cognizant of actually what's going on. Well, thanks for being with us this week. We want to invite you to come and be a guest on the Blind Handyman Show or the Blind Like Me Show. And all guests, of course, are provided room service and a free room at the beautiful Blind Handyman Hotel. So that's one advantage to being a guest on the show, the Blind Handyman Hotel. But we'd like to have you as a guest. You can email me, Phil at philparr.net or philparr@consolidated.net. philparr@consolidated.net or phil@philparr.net. Or you can call me if you really want to do that. I won't guarantee I'll be free to talk, but I'll call you back if I'm not. 936-634-9500. That is my phone number, and I'd like to hear from you. We do about 80 of these shows a year, 40 so Blind Handyman and 40, one or two of these, Blind Like Me, and so we need guests every week, and we'd like to have you as a guest, so come and be 936-634-9500, phil@philparr.net, or philparr@consolidated.net. Thank you, and we'll see you next week on Blind Like Me.